You just have to keep going. You have to want it enough to wake up tomorrow and do the same thing over.
This was me being a hustler. Man.
The only way that I've gotten to this point in my life is to try to treat people the way I want to be treated.
Welcome to Ground Zero Growth with your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbaud.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ground Zero Growth. I'm joined today by the esteemed Will Aiken, Clay County Sheriff. How are you doing, Will?
I'm doing very well, thank you, and thank you so much for having me on your show.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure. I think the first time I saw you speak at a Kearney Chamber of Commerce event, it was a good one. So then I got to meet you afterwards, and we know a lot of the same people, so it's been fun ever since. I like that you're really approachable. I mean, I guess that's kind of obvious. Like you would hope, right, that your county sheriff is an approachable individual. Yet I think a lot of people don't typically think about that role as being approachable.
No, and you know, that's one of the things that that I tell people. It's, you know, the sheriff is a unique elected position because, yes, I have the law that I have to enforce, but at the same time, I'm still, and as much as I hate saying this, it's reality, is I'm still a politician. I was still elected by the people to serve in this capacity. So, I mean, why would I not want to talk with the people that put me in office? I mean, I'm here representing them. So by all means, funny story real quick. A gentleman was a judge in Philadelphia. He just moved to Clay County a couple months ago, and he doesn't know anyone here other than his family. And he reached out to me and said, hey, look, I've always wanted to like just meet the sheriff. Are you available to meet? And I responded to him. I was like, absolutely. When can you come over? And he was like, he came over and he said, I was really surprised that you reached out to me and said, yeah, let's meet.
That in and of itself is a fascinating notion. So my first question is, because that to me sounds like, we haven't talked about it before. I haven't thought about it, but there are competing motives there, aren't there? Arguably. I mean, on one hand, people got to end up in jail and we got to keep an eye on them and we got to serve warrants and we got to, you know, that's what we do. On the other hand, we need to be likable and approachable because we need to vote, right? How do you balance that?
Very carefully. And I tell you, that's a really big challenge because if I have an opinion one direction or another, then I am at risk of isolating a certain segment of my constituency. And I don't want to do that. And fortunately, Clay County, back in 2020, the people voted for our charter form of government, which actually removed the partisanship in all county offices when they run. So I am literally the only nonpartisan sheriff in the entire state of Missouri. And I really like that because that affords me a little bit more latitude when I go to balance enforcing the law and still having to be a politician. Yes, I have my opinions, but you know my story, and I'm sure we're going to get into it. But I can relate to the entire spectrum of sociopolitical issues because of my background and where I came from, and now dealing with the issues that we have to deal with in our communities. And and I put in a lot of hard work to get where I'm at today. And you know, no one gets a free pass. I mean, if you're trying, then you're trying, and you're already winning. You know, but we have to remember to celebrate those little victories and not just wait for the big one, because I think for the most part, we all have little victories, and it's just, it doesn't do us any justice if we don't celebrate them. So yeah, it's a balancing act. And I figure as long as I am approachable, then you know what, let's have a conversation. And at the end of the conversation, if we get to a point where we have to agree to disagree, then at least we had the conversation. But yeah, I mean, it's really easy for me to talk with people. And my family will tell you that I don't know a stranger. So
it's a good thing, probably, for sure. So you're telling me a lot of counties, if I heard this right, and I'm making sure I understand, a lot of counties, if you run for sheriff, or some counties, if you run for sheriff, you have to run as a Republican or Democrat. Did I get that right?
Yes. Basically? So we have 114 counties in the state of Missouri. St. Louis is a little different. St. Louis City Sheriff, they have a sheriff. So we have 115 sheriffs. Now, out of 114 counties, we are the only county that runs on nonpartisan ticket.
Wow. Which, I mean, I that's, well, okay, we're going to get a little bit more political than we should. I'm an independent, right? And that's what I've loved about Missouri is you can vote at any point as an independent. Really doesn't matter. To your point, I have my own views. I tend to lean a particular direction. But my opinion is always like, you know, put the person in the seat that's gonna get it done. It's fascinating to me because that sounds like an extra layer of politics you wouldn't want in the sheriff's role. I mean, you've already got the two competing things, which I think I'm glad it's an elected role. That seems like a good notion, right? But then you have to care for your constituents, but you also have to occasionally serve them papers. But there's another layer you're saying where you also kind of have to, while caring for your constituents, you have to care for a particular party of constituents more than another party, but you also kind of have to win them over too. And
well, you know, and that's the thing, like, make no mistake, I'm nonpartisan, but if you go to a particular party's Facebook page, you're going to see pictures of me, you know, and it's just, that's the nature of who we are and the nature of our country.
Yeah.
Now, politically, you know, and historically, especially in Missouri, if you run as an independent, then you might get 2% of the votes. And I know people have their own opinions about the party system that we have, you know, and like, I'm not going to be the one that changes any of that. But at the same time, I've made it very clear that although I lean in one direction, that doesn't mean I'm going to neglect the other side. And I tell you, there have been many times over the last 4 years where I work with the other side more than the side that I lean toward. And the reason for it is because when you get to the state level, that's when things start becoming really tricky. You're no longer having to just represent your constituency back at home, but you have to play the system at that level and beyond. Because if you don't, then you effectively become ineffective. Like, no one's going to listen to you. Like, we have state reps in office right now that are angry because they don't have a bill up on their wall. Well, they're so extreme that nobody, not even their own side, wants to listen to what they have to say. And so that's where it gets tricky. But here at home, you know, there's really no reason to have partisan politics behind it anymore because, you know, I don't have to worry about that system, so to say. So what I've done to kind of ease that issue is I'm friends with everyone. And I make it very clear that, yes, I lean one direction, but I'm not going to neglect the other side. And so how am I able to do that? Very easily. It has taken years of trying to build relationships. If you think you're going to run for office and, you know, you kind of mentioned earlier, like, and you don't even have a Facebook page, you're not going to win. Like, you know, people, as much as they don't like social media, it is an absolute necessity because who are you? And if you haven't built that relationship or at least that reputation of, you know, being open and honest, as transparent as you possibly can get, then people are going to know who you are. So they're going to go with, you know, the name that they see more often.
Right. 100%. Well, and for those so we were talking, me and Will were talking a little bit beforehand. And it's interesting. I think I have this passing fancy of like running for something at some point. I think it's just kind of the, like, you know, when you, and I'm starting to hang around with more elected officials. And so I've started to kind of pay a little bit more attention to things like, did the person that showed up at the top of the ballot win the vote? Did the person that was on the ballot that was my friend campaign? How much did they campaign? What's been fascinating to me has been, you know, I think marketing is difficult for a small business owner. The way I describe it is sometimes it's like you're shouting at the top of your lungs into a voice, and sometimes a whisper comes back. And you, because you wonder, like, if your shouting is doing anything, and then you get a whisper. Campaigning, it really does seem like, and I'd be interested to hear your experience. It really does seem like you need to do parades and you need to have a Facebook page and you need to have a managed Facebook page and you need to, you know, say a lot and you need to do as much podcasts and this sort of thing as possible. And you need to da, 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 da. And then you do all that and you maybe win by like 2 votes.
Yeah. You know, and it's almost like, yes, I won only by 2, you know, like 2 points. I mean, wow, did I really win? I mean, did I make the other side, or, you know, did I bring more people to the polls? You know, and then you start kind of questioning yourself on how effective were you in your campaign? But I tell you, running a campaign is extremely, extremely difficult because, to your point, marketing. If you don't have a social media presence, you're already too far behind, especially when no one knows you. Now, for me, I was the spokesperson for the Clay County Sheriff's Office for almost 8 years. So I've already built that reputation in our community of that's the guy who I want to see on TV when a tornado rips through Clay County somewhere, you know, because I've always been truthful. I've always been open. Our media partners know that if they want a story, they can always reach out to the Clay County Sheriff's Office. So I had that reputation built, but I also had a social media presence. And, you know, if you look at my social media, there's nothing negative on there. Well, let me rephrase that. I'm 99.9% sure there's nothing negative on there. I think I might have snapped, about a particular issue or once or twice. But for the most part, you know, I want people to know who I am as a person. And I open my personal life up for people to see that, hey, look, I am a regular person. Because at the end of the day, when this uniform comes off, who am I? I'm your next door neighbor. I'm a husband. I'm a dad. I'm the guy who's going to shovel your snow off your driveway if you need help, you know, or if you've been gone. Like, I'm fortunate enough to have great neighbors, and I was actually out of town when the last snowstorm came through. And when I came back, my driveway was shoveled. I was like, well, I mean, if I wasn't a good guy, I don't think they would have done that for me. But
that's fantastic, especially during that, because there were posts like the Kansas City mayor was posting, you know, if you've got teens, to have them shovel somebody's driveway. And I don't think I fully understood that until there was a friend of mine. I was talking to her and she was saying that nobody really got out and shoveled the snow like they used to. There was maybe like one set of kids making a killing shoveling people's snow because they were the only ones out there doing it. So,
you know, and when you talk about, and I think we're going to get to this, you know, talking about crime and community and stuff like that, but you know, people ask me, what is the best way for me to protect my home, you know, from crime, property crimes? And I share a story, not to get too far off track, but I share a story with them. When I first started in law enforcement, I worked for the Phoenix Police Department, and a call for service came in, and the call was, somebody stole my house. And I was like, I didn't understand, I stole your house? No, when I got there, the house was still there. Everything inside the home was gone. And so I started talking with the neighbors, and the neighbors told me, oh, well, we don't really know them, but we saw a U-Haul truck there all day, and we just thought they were moving. These people literally stole every piece of thing they owned in their house in one day's time, put it in a U-Haul truck, and drove off. The neighbors never knew who they were. So I tell people, I'm like, the best way, one of the best ways to secure your homestead is to know who your neighbors are. We're at a time and a place now with all the technology that when we come home, I can open my garage door with my phone and I'd never have to step out of my garage, right? I just close the door and then I walk in. Like, okay, so if you're not out meeting your neighbors, you know, the way things used to be without or before technology, that allowed us to know who our neighbors were. But now it's almost like, I don't want to be bothered. I've got too much going on. I'm so busy, and you know, whatever reasons we come up with, but know who your neighbors are. Know the 3 neighbors behind you, know the 3 neighbors across the street, and know the neighbors who live beside you. And that's like one of the best ways to protect your home. If your neighbors don't know who you are, you're at risk. But you know, going back to the shoveling snow, get the kids out there.
Get the kids out there. I have a fun tip, by the way, learning this, like this is new for me because I kind of struggle sometimes, believe it or not, Will, to be the person to like just walk up to one of my strangers cold and try to strike up a conversation. It's a little difficult. It's easy when I have a premise, But up until then, it's difficult. If you want all your neighbors to know you, put a security camera or two on your house, make it known, they will come to you, and pick up lock picking. They will, all my neighbors for the most part now know, Sam is the guy with a security camera and a lock pick set. So when we're locked out or crime is happening, they show up on my door. And it has been a blessing because I've gotten to know my neighbors a lot better over the course of that. Yeah. So
it's funny you bring that up because I have cameras on my house and I also know how to pick locks.
And are you rang up every a little bit?
Yeah,
approached,
you know what,
more,
neighbors,
would you say?
Neighbors, you know, they come up to me and said, hey, somebody ran into my car, but I don't know who it was. And I'm like, sure, let me check the cameras. And sure enough, we see the car, you know, we get the license plate. I'm like, well, here you go. Let the cops know.
And cameras aren't that expensive. I feel like that is, this is legitimate advice, folks. If you ever had a knack for lockpicking and a camera or two, it'll pay off.
Yeah, definitely cameras. Oh my gosh. I mean, it's just another layer of security for your home too.
Yeah. Negative side effect. There's pros and cons to everything. You will know when a lot of crime is going on that maybe you would have rather not known. There's all this stuff that like my neighbors don't know is going on that I do know is going on because I have a camera. And a side effect to having the camera is sometimes people will approach me and be like, hey, out of curiosity, like somebody stole my car. Do you know who stole my car? And it's like, sure. Now I know your car was stolen. I wouldn't have known otherwise. It's not like there's some, it's not hitting the news when your neighbor's car got stolen.
No, so it's not, but you know, and really that's the negative side effect, right? So we are more aware of what's happening. Another negative side effect is people being drawn to it because they're afraid. And, you know, you really have to take into consideration, like, yes, crime happens. No community is without crime to a certain percentage. But there are some communities, like, there's a lot of crime. And then there are some communities where, yes, a car gets stolen here or there because you left the doors unlocked and the keys in the console or up in the visor. You left, and I kid you not, you left $5,000 in your center console, which I don't know about you, but I don't have $5,000 to leave in my car unsecure. That is just mind blowing to me. But you know, it's almost self-inflicted.
Problem to have for that person.
Yeah, but a lot of the property crimes that happen, you know, in Clay County, I will just say that it's really self-inflicted, and you know, sometimes it goes unreported. And look, I get it. We make mistakes. We feel oftentimes that it'll never happen to me, so I'll leave my doors unlocked or something like that. Well, we're not immune to it. I mean, shoot.
No.
My son's car in my driveway next to my patrol car, which albeit unmarked, they got into his car and stole some change out of the center console. And we know it because we were like, why is the door cracked open at this time of the morning? So it even happens to the sheriff.
Well, it does, and it's in that moment. You know, when my car got stolen, I came out. It's a decent story. That's why I don't mind telling it. It's the one that I feel like anybody could do, but then in retrospect, people are like, really? I came out, I started the car, which for anybody that wonders how a keyless start works, you're about to learn a lesson because this has been if there's a good thing that's come out of this story, it's been this awareness. I already knew this, by the way. I was just being stupid. So I came out, I started the car. I needed to air up the tires. I've got a little remote error. So I air up the tires. My hands are dirty. I'm going to go inside to wash my hands. 3 minutes. This is a 3-minute ordeal. I find out later people were already, because of the camera, I had a camera, people were already casing the joint. And they were about to leave the neighborhood. They had passed my car. They were checking out. And as I'm walking in my home, they see this, back up, hop out, hop in my car, drive off. I'm back, because again, timed it, 3 minutes. I wash my hands, change my polo, come out, and it's gone. Which is the craziest thing that maybe people have experienced, maybe people haven't. But when you come out and your car just isn't where it was, the first thing that goes through your head isn't my car got stolen. The first thing is like, there's a reality where my car was here, and I'm now in reality where my car isn't. What happened?
And then you get that like gut feeling like, no way. First we enter denial. We're like, no way. No way could my car have been stolen in the 3 minutes that I was away.
I forgot where I left it. That seems, you know, more likely.
So we experience a lot of times when people on a cold day, they'll run into a QT or another convenience store and they'll leave their cars running thinking, oh, my car's okay because I have my fob in my pocket. No one's going to take it. But but we know that's
the lesson that people have been learning from this. No, yeah. Thank you for because I have had multiple people after the, again, I knew already, just being stupid, but I've had multiple people that like, oh, did you leave your keys in the car? It's like, no. And they're like, oh, well, mine shuts off when I put it in reverse. That's true if you did remote start. If you started it and walked away, every car that I've ever known, because I've talked to friends that have had kind of similar things happen, the car will go into reverse and it'll go into drive just if you shut it off. But anyway.
And I think different manufacturers are different. And there's no way I can know like the nuances of every single one.
Oh, sure.
I
mean, there's probably, you know, one or two that are different, but most of them I don't think are.
And perhaps it's the higher end cars like Mercedes or BMW or something, but you know,
maybe,
you know, the ones that are stolen really aren't those kind of cars. So it's like the best thing is to just be mindful of what you're doing. Secure everything. You know, the old Midwestern days of I used to leave my house and leave all my doors unlocked and my windows wide open. Yeah, I'm afraid that those days are long behind us now. We have to be very mindful.
Yeah, it's tricky. So since we're down this rabbit hole and my curiosity is taking over, we're just going to keep going. So how does one kind of help with being... I can't think of a better way to put it than jaded. So and I'll put myself on the line here. I worked in a call center help desk, and you'd get calls from all over. I would get calls from the middle of nowhere where internet barely existed, and they would wonder why streaming Netflix was a problem. And oh, by the way, their entire home was hooked up to their car battery. And it was through a very thick Southern accent, like the kind that you see on TV where you're like, I'm sorry I'm asking you to repeat yourself five times, but I was not aware that somebody else on this earth could speak English and I wouldn't be able to understand them. And so over time, you kind of get jaded. You kind of get to a point where you're like, okay, unplug and plug the modem back in. Well, I already did that. And it's like, yeah, but the last person said they did too, and I find out they're lying, so I'm going to tell you to do it again. You know, you just... And so in the same sort of vein, I think that sometimes what people might miss, right, is that when you're an upholder of the law, by its very nature, you are going to see more crime, such that if you weren't open to it, you might think everybody's a criminal, right? And you're going to see more violent crime, and you're going to see more atrocities, and you know, you're going to see have people lie to you more. You're going to have, and I don't know about it, but I'm guessing there's even training videos out there where you pull somebody over for a ticket and then they pull out a gun and shoot you. So then you've got that going through your head where you're like, this person doesn't seem violent, but there's really nothing guaranteeing that they won't just pull out a gun and shoot me, and I want to get home to my family. So how, at the end of the day, does an officer in general, sheriff or otherwise, handle that?
Wow, that's a lot to unpack. Usually when I do speaking presentations, and I kind of cover this particular topic, you know, well, let me answer this from two different perspectives. So in law enforcement, we have to be mindful on how we train our police officer, law enforcement professionals, because yes, our job is to help people literally on the worst day of their life. Now, you know, having a car stolen versus having your brother shot and killed, like, that's two very different things. But at the same time, the worst day of your life is still in that realm right then at that moment in time. So what we have to do is explain, listen, every contact we make outside of a public relations contact is you're there to help people. And we might see the same crime 100 times in a month, but we can't treat everyone the same. You know, some people just kind of shrug it off and go, yeah, I was a dummy. I left my keys in the car running and somebody took it. You know, I own that. Where, you know, another person might do the same thing and just their world just collapses because they don't, you know, they're barely making ends meet. And how are they going to have transportation to go to work? And, you know, all these things happen. So it's not just, you know, let me figure out, you know, let me take your report for a stolen car and then move on to the next, you know, traumatic experience that somebody's happened or having. You know, we have to keep in mind that, hey, look, we are the ones who are fixing, addressing, de-escalating that situation, regardless of how it is. Like, we're the ones. And so if you keep that in mind, I think, I mean, trust me, believe me, we have bad days too. And sometimes, you know, we have a bad day and we take it out on a citizen. And so this is what I tell people on the other side of that coin is when I have a bad day, give me some grace because your stolen car, regardless of what your circumstances are, in my world at that moment in time is not as important as the two kids that I just had to pull out of a pond or out of a hot car who just died or, you know, a homicide where an entire family of five was killed by the shooter. Then they killed themselves like that. That will mess us up. And then, oh, okay. So we're talking about a car. What about a house party? My neighbors are being too loud. Their dog is barking. It's like, we get there and we're like, are you effing kidding me? Like, what, have you talked with your neighbor? Well, no, I haven't done that. I don't know how to talk to people. But try talking to them, you know? So really what I do is I say, please give me some grace. You know, you have no idea what call for service I just came from.
No, that's a good way of putting it. And I don't even think jaded is the right word. I wish I had a better one. It's the one I'm using for myself, not for... It's a defense mechanism. So, like, you know, in the help desk side, when I got calls where they were just absolutely screaming at me livid because they couldn't watch the football game because their internet was offline or everybody's internet was offline, it did not faze me because I had already gotten past this point of like, it's a shadowless voice on the other phone and, you know, I've got my own problems to deal with, right? But then conversely, like, I've had other friends or family go through literally the exact same organization, and they're coming home just destroyed each night. And it's like, what happened? It's like, oh, I took a call today, and they were screaming at me at the top of their lungs, and they called me the worst person on planet Earth. I was like, oh, what was their problem? It's like, they couldn't watch the football game. I'm like, oh, man, it's weird for me because I'm like, you're taking that personally? And it's like, yeah. I'm like, those were kind of my favorite phone calls. It's like, what's your problem? Yeah. It's like, well, I didn't have to do any work. I just said I'm sorry every couple minutes in a sort of automatic fashion. And then, I'd help them. I'd dispatch a tech and I'd hang up and go to the next phone call. So anyway, I think the point there is there's this weird happy medium between so invested that you are putting your own psyche on the line and so detached that you're not in the other person's shoes, where it's like, to your point about the NFL person, like, for all I know, they just had somebody pass away in their life, right? And it's like, it probably wasn't even the football game that they were mad about. It was probably something completely unrelated. And I could have been more empathetic.
Yeah. And, you know, so that's why it's important for mental health and wellness, at least in law enforcement or for first responders in general, You know, we see stuff every day. I mean, we're like, there's such a significant exposure to traumatic stuff, whether it's personally or vicariously through the people that we are called to help. You know, so when you think about, okay, if a first world problem exists and I respond to somebody's house and they're yelling and screaming at me because we're not able to help the way they think that we can help. I mean, because laws, we have to follow the law. If we can help you, we can. If we can't, we can't.
Right.
That's only, okay, so that's only one time. But what happens when it's 20 times a day and for, you know, not every day, but let's just say 3-4 times a week, you know? And,
yeah.
And it's just week after week, month after month that it happens. You know, that's going to wear us down. Because if you think about when
and it'll be particularly difficult when you want to help, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's like, you know, they're beating up on me or something, and you're like, these laws say X, Y, Z, and I can't. I want to go and punch them, but
yeah. Oh,
I can't do that.
We can't do that. Yeah. But you know, so we're exposed to this, and then no one gives us not no one, but then there's this belief that we should be immune to those kinds of things. Well, okay, let me. Equate that to a child who is in a verbally abusive household and mom and dad's narcissistic, and they you know, use the one child as a scapegoat for everything. How do you think that child's going to grow up? You know, in yes, granted, our brains at, you know, once we reach a certain age, stop developing, but that doesn't mean that the constant barrage of people yelling and screaming at us for one reason or another doesn't get to us eventually, you know. And then when it comes to, and I've been there, you know, I would respond to calls for service where in my mind I'm like, you really called the police to come out here and to deal with this for you? Or, you know, people will call and I respond and I stand there and I look at the husband and wife or the boyfriend and girlfriend arguing on the front porch and I don't say anything. And then finally they look at me and I go, hey, if you guys are ready for me to be the adult in this interaction, or you can be the adult and stop yelling and screaming at each other, and we can talk this out and perhaps find some resolution, you know, what's going on, you know? And then, you know, a lot of times they kind of laugh and they're like, yeah, sorry about that. But in my mind, I'm going, you're acting like children. Why am I here? No crime's been committed.
Yeah.
So you know, it's kind of hard to balance that out too. But at the end of the day, I love my job, and so do most law enforcement. I'm not going to say they're all, you know, they all love their job. Some people, unfortunately, are just doing it because it's a paycheck. That's not very healthy. But nonetheless, we love our job, and we want to help people. And, you know, just give us some grace when we kind of snap, have a little, you know, breakdown. And it happens to be at your house because it's a first world problem, and you know where I'm going.
No, 100%. Why? I've heard of stories where an officer had a rule where if they showed up on the holidays, somebody was going to jail. And so they would tell the person, like, hey, I'm showing up on Thanksgiving. You've had an argument. Can you deal with it yourself or does somebody need to go to jail? And the interesting outcome and the bit that I think most interesting is it's my understanding that about 10 out of 10 times, all of a sudden they could deal with the argument themselves. To your point, this is kind of a callback to your point of, do you want me to be the adult here?
Yeah.
Do you think there's an appropriate focus on mental health for these fields?
Wow. You know what? 20 years ago, if you would have asked me that, at the beginning of my law enforcement career, I would have said absolutely not. Anything that you ever hear about mental health and well-being in law enforcement was only because someone told them they had to. You know, there was such a stigma of even considering the possibility that I might be suffering from PTSD because of one incident, or complex PTSD because of, I've been a cop now for 2 years and I've worked 50 homicides in West Phoenix. And, you know, yeah, that was a different time. But today, I'm not saying that we've got it figured out, but I will say that we're doing we're doing a much, much better job today in trying to break down that stigma and letting our law enforcement professionals know that, hey, look, if you're dealing with problems, deal with, you know, go to a professional, get some help. I've made it to where in our organization, and let's face it, we're always the last ones to see that we need help or even admit that we need help. But the people that we work around, I mean, we spend more waking hours at work with each other than we do with our own families. I mean, if you really break down the time spent at work and versus at home. But I have literally taken people and told them, I'm ordering you to go get some help. Otherwise, your job is at risk. You know, not because I want to fire them. It's because I want to preserve them, the best version of them as possible. Because let's face it, when we hit that breaking point, and we all have a breaking point, when we hit that breaking point, oftentimes it's irrecoverable. Like we can't make it right again. So I would much rather have somebody, an employee, a teammate, be pissed off at me because I made them go see a therapist, a culturally competent therapist, not just any therapist who knows nothing about law enforcement. But when I send them and then I see them a month later, because now they've had a couple sessions under their belt, maybe three or four, and they come back to me and they say, Sheriff, thank you so much for seeing what I couldn't see in myself. And I'm like, wow, that just makes it melts my heart, because I'm like, wow, it feels like I literally saved a teammate rather than now having to deal with termination and possibly criminal charges because enough was enough. And for whatever reason, they used excessive use of force trying to take somebody into custody, but they were already handcuffed. And, you know, it's just, I would much rather deal with it in advance than wait till it breaks and then have to deal with it. And so to answer your question, I think we're doing a much better job. Now, with that being said, we have a tremendous amount of room to grow, but we are today in a much better place than we were even 10 years ago.
What I like that, I like what you say too about we're the last to notice in ourselves, because I think you're 100% accurate. It's been interesting to me because while I've seen therapists before, I've been surprised at, you know, just talking with other people and listening to their upbringing and what they went through, and literally sometimes even in the context of this podcast, and layering what I've gone through over top of theirs has been its own kind of therapy. Because it's been like, you know, I asked somebody, you know, why do you think that way? And then they're recounting back to a scenario that sounded almost downright abusive or whatever. And they're literally, I think this way. And it's a good thing because of that situation. And then I'm sitting here like, I think that way. And then I'm like layering over top and I'm like, is that why? But so how do you, this is going to sound maybe it's a funner one, but how do you unplug? And unfortunately, I'm not going to let you go that easy, because one thing I had noticed personally was I hadn't known a cop to not be caring at all times. I hope I'm not letting the cat out of the bag on that one. But I knew a woman who was getting married, and this is how inquisitive I am. For anybody out there being like, you ask good questions, I've done it my whole freaking life. I couldn't help myself. So I run up to the woman and I'm like, I know a lot of police officers. Are you carrying underneath the wedding dress? And she looks at me deadpan, like she's been seen for the first time, right? She goes like, oh, somebody knows. And she's like, I have a K-bar. I do not have my gun with me. The only reason I do not is because my future husband, who is also an officer, I is carrying underneath. That is the only reason I am not. And so, but it's a fun thing. You know, it's fun to talk about. It's kind of funny overall. But over time, it makes me wonder, like, are you ever really unplugged?
That is a great question, because I think that fits very well into the mental health and well-being, right? So we're trained, I mean, much like the military, and I've had experience in both, but in law enforcement, we, in basic training, basic police academy, we break recruits down and build them back up in a way that they can keep themselves safe and the people that they are tasked to protect safe, right? Safe and secure environment at all times. So we constantly live on the edge. Well, look, when you're constantly stressed out, we know physiologically that that is not good. And that's what causes obesity. That's what causes cortisol rates to increase. That's what causes heart attacks, strokes. I mean, there are so many side effects caused by stress that leads to up to loss of life, right? So how do we do that in law enforcement? Well, I don't know. I'm not very good at it because I love my job. And it seems like if you ask my wife, that I'm always at work, even when I'm at home, right? So it's especially in leadership positions in law enforcement, because not only do we have our job, like for me, not only do I have my job as sheriff, but I also have roughly 225 employees that absolutely need me to be aware of what's going on in our organization to provide the best working environment for them. You know, the tools that they need to do their job. And I'm not just talking about our sworn employees. I'm talking about our non-sworn detention officers. I'm talking about our warrant clerks. I'm talking about our front desk clerks. Like, I have to make sure that the entire organization that I'm aware of everything that is going on. Now, I can't know everything, but that's why I have my executive staff and my command staff and so forth. But when my phone rings or I see an email come through, it's almost like if I don't check it, my anxiety rises. So I'm constantly on call. Like people say, do you ever get a day off? And I'm like, psh, no way. However, the way I separate and kind of reset is going places where there is no cell service. And one of the things that I love doing is backcountry backpacking. And, you know, I have a satellite communicator, my Garmin inReach, and I'm able to let my wife know, hey, I'm safe. I'm leaving camp. I'll be going to X location. You know, I'll give her the coordinates or the location of the name, and I'll keep you posted as we're going. And so it works out great. I can send her little pre-canned text messages and stuff like that. It works through my phone. It's all through the satellite, you know, and I'm away. My phone doesn't work, so I can't look at my emails. I can't look at text messages. And it's a way to force myself. Now, I will say in the same breath that that in itself causes me anxiety because I don't know what's going on. I've literally separated myself from work and everything that's happening. So it's a give and take. You know, on one day I'm doing well. The next day I'm like, oh my gosh, I haven't heard from anyone. Then I'm like, no. I have to convince myself I'm away. There's a reason why I'm out in the middle of nowhere. It's to be away. And then it kind of settles in. It's like, you know what? Not only am I gone, but I have a great team. And I know that when I do leave, they will be able to take care of things until I get back. And so I have to really, you know, at the end of the day, I attribute to my ability to get away and separate to the capabilities that my team has at work. That's how I do it.
So it's interesting. I know it sounds crazy, but I'm layering business over top because as a business owner, it's our baby, right? I mean, we've hired people. They rely on us to bring food to the table. And the way I've said it for entrepreneurship in particular, there really has to be a point where you almost like buy in past all reason, because when the paycheck didn't come in that one day and you could have taken a 9-to-5 making way more and you don't want to get out of bed, you still have to get out of bed. And when somebody's looking at you like, hey, are we coming into work today or whatever, right? You if you haven't bought into the point beyond reason, you know, so in the same sort of vein, like I've had to be very careful with notifications on my phone. Because it got to the point to where Facebook's dinging my phone, LinkedIn's dinging my phone, a text message saying, oh my goodness, we're down, is dinging my phone. And the problem was I had to start disabling a lot of them. I got really intimate with the notification settings on my phone because each ding came in the same way. And I held each ding while I'm in the bathroom on the toilet at the same severity as, oh my goodness, we're down, because there was no guarantee that that wasn't the case. fun tip, sensory deprivation chambers. Have you done one of those before?
Not yet, but I'm actually considering it.
If you need a mini oasis that's like a stronger, compact, 1 hour version of the hike, I think a sensory deprivation chamber works pretty well for that. Yeah. So you and I should go sometime if you're ever feeling up for it.
That'd be awesome. But hey, you know, I do want to say that, you know, it's kind of like Pavlov's dogs, right? They ring the bell and they start salivating. Yeah. And that's where that ding comes in. And to your point, like, it doesn't matter what you're doing or what the severity is, that response is the same. And so, like, you've turned your notifications off. For me, I've turned all sounds and haptics off, so I don't get the dings. And so now I know that, okay, my phone is right here and I have a privacy screen, so I can't really see if it turns on. So it's like, okay, I know it's almost like a security blanket, like, okay, there's my phone. I can check it when I have time. And then when I check it, yeah, I may have missed a phone call or something, or, you know, a text message that needs to be addressed. But I have found that in my position, there's never an emergency that I've missed. Now we have emergencies. Don't, you know, without me like muddying the waters, like when we have an employee who has been injured on the job, that's an emergency. But me missing that phone call and getting back to it 5 minutes later isn't going to change the fact that our teammate was hurt or my response to that teammate at the hospital. 5 minutes is nothing. Yeah. And so, you know what? I will be there and I'm sorry this happened, but I'll tell my wife, hey, look, I've got to go. And she completely understands it. And I tell you, you know, that's also a source for me of support that I know I can do my job because my wife understands that if we're somewhere and something happens, it's let's go. I got to go to work. She completely understands.
Well, and that's where, you know, the 5 minute thing, and I think in the wrong context, people can misunderstand. But at the end of the day, it's your self-health and mental health really is priority one. And the thing that really kind of stuck with me, I think it was like Theodore Roosevelt. There's one of these presidents, you can look it up, and I'm not going to quote it perfectly, but he went to sleep the same time every night, and he slept through that. It didn't matter what war was going on. It didn't matter what. He went to sleep the same time, and he woke up the same time. And he was very militant about it. Everybody knew. It's like, okay, it's bedtime. He's in bed. We can't reach him. We can't get in touch with him. And that's the highest position we have in the country. And but at the end of the day, to your point, it's like nuclear fallout's huge, but it's still a problem in the morning, just like it was in the middle of the night. But at the end of the day, what I think about is how sound, I mean, it's Theodore Roosevelt, so pretty sound, right? Was that guy when it came to making these decisions that really mattered at the point they mattered? Because they weren't muddied down. And the truth of the matter is, and this is, I think, your point, 99.99999% of the time, it is not nuclear fallout. Your worst case scenario is it's somebody else that thinks it's nuclear fallout. I'll call on myself. I was more of the latter than the former when you were describing the person getting their car stolen and their mine was a little bit closer to my world had fallen apart. And it was really because I just couldn't believe that something like this would happen to me. And I'm like, I've got the security footage and the camera, and the dispatcher that I'm talking to was rather dismissive, probably had a bad day. I love what you said there. And, you know, she kind of had to check me. She was like, there is a lot of crime happening in Kansas City right now. There are a lot of officers dealing with that crime. We're going to take care of your crime as soon as we can, but we're triaging it, which is exactly the thing I might say to somebody in a tech scenario where I'm like, your desktop icon is missing. I have somebody's internet down. So I get it. But at the time, it was... So to that end, the point is, yeah, sometimes we make noise. Sometimes I cause noise, right? And if that dispatcher, right, didn't have a full night's sleep, you know, she might start cursing me out. I don't know. She might just gone off on me. And then I've been like, whoa, what world am I living in? But so, yeah, it's crazy. We went a little bit off the rails, and I don't know if we're going to be able to go through too much because but fortunately, you and I talked about it. We can go a little bit over. You might just have to like wave at me or something. Let's kind of reset. And I normally ask folks, what was your first dream right around high school, college? But I think we're going to have to go a little bit earlier than that because you have a really intriguing 8 years old that I had the pleasure of listening to on a podcast. Actually, I should shout out that podcast because I'll do that because if people want to learn even more about you, the Washdown Podcast, episode 86, the first 10 minutes of that, the first 10 to 20 minutes are more than enough to like hook you into learning more about Will Aiken's upbringing. So we're not going to be able to get through enough of it. People are welcome to jump onto that podcast. But can you tell folks a little bit about your upbringing and then that first dream?
Well, you know, it's really tough because there's so much, but, you know, I've tried to summarize it as I started a few years ago sharing my story because it hasn't always been an easy story for me to share. It's been an embarrassing story because I didn't know, like back then, like how I should share it and such like that. But to summarize it, you know, my father left when I was 3 years old, left my mom and my brother. By 8 years old, we ended up being homeless for 2 years. And this is all in California. And then ended up dropping out of high school at 16 years old, getting my GED at 18, and then joining the military. But, you know, talking about the childhood, you know, and more specifically being homeless. And really, this is, and it's funny you're asking the question of what was my first dream. And I just remember, you know, and I'm really remembering now, and I kind of mentioned to you, I'm actually writing a book now, but as I've been writing, more memories have been coming back. But the first dream I ever had was I wanted to do something that I never had to deal with the challenges that my mother had to deal with. Not the challenges I had to deal with, but it was my mother, because I remember, I have memories of my mother crying, trying to hide it, because all we could eat was beans and rice. And that was before being homeless. And being homeless was a challenge in itself, you know, but for an 8-year-old boy, it was like the best time of my life. Now, I say that today, but not 42 years ago. Every morning I would wake up and we would have Egg McMuffins from McDonald's. Yeah, that's great. You know, and then we would go and, you know, we'd go to school, and for lunch, all we would ever get to eat, because they didn't have social services back then, like we do today, you know, with free lunch programs and stuff like that. But the only time I would ever get to eat is when my friends had something in their lunch bag or lunch box that they didn't want to eat, and then they would share with me. Well, for years, and really up until about 3 years ago, I never talked about what we did for dinner. And it wasn't until a TV reporter was interviewing my brother and I. My brother used to work here at the sheriff's office. I didn't hire him because that's nepotism. That's against the law. He actually worked with the previous sheriff. I didn't have to fire him. But the reporter talked with me and asked me questions about that time frame. And I shared the way I remembered it. But then she interviewed my brother. And she goes, you know, your brother talked about, you know, breakfast and lunch. What'd you guys do for dinner? And he was like, oh my gosh. He goes, man, we would go behind grocery stores and go dumpster diving. And when he said that, literally like 40 years of blocking that out came crashing down on me. And I was like, oh my gosh. And I just remember when I was an 8-year-old boy, 9, how difficult it was for me to process what we were doing. I always felt like we were doing something wrong. I was always waiting to get in trouble. I was waiting for the cops to show up. Now, and it's interesting because when I was growing up, there was no community-oriented policing in the neighborhoods that I grew up in. When the cops showed up, we just ran. Because if you weren't doing something wrong, then you were going to end up being the snitch. And then everyone else was going to want to kick your, you know, butt for that. So we never talked with the cops. So being behind a grocery store, dumpster diving, waiting for the cops to come, it was overwhelming to the point where I literally blocked that out of my mind for 40 years, you know? And Yeah. So, but now here I am, 22 years in law enforcement, and never thought I'd be a cop. But I'm really glad I made that jump and being in the position that I am in today. But yeah, that's kind of how I summarize it. And with a little bit of dash on top of the homeless piece.
Yeah. There's a lot there. You mentioned the whole, cop-wise, I had a different upbringing. You know, my parents were pretty good at, you know, for the most part, they're there to help. Don't go into an unmarked vehicle assuming it's a cop. It's interesting because I've had friends that closer carry the notion that you're talking about, where it's like, well, look, you're either in trouble or you're the snitch. And it's difficult because it's like it, how do you go from one to the other? I mean, Will, you're wearing the uniform. How do you jump that hurdle?
I think for everyone who has walked a similar path, I think everything is circumstantial. You know, for me, I finally got my GED when I was 18, joined the Army, because I had to get away from my neighborhood. My neighborhood was really not good for me. I was working three jobs to help support my mom and my brother. And I, you know, had no intention of ever going back to school because, let's face it, I was a terrible student. There's another story to that, but I was just bored and I thought that it was more important to help my mom and my brother than it was to go to school, something that I hated to do. So circumstances led me to when I was 26 years old and I was in the Army and I was a Black Hawk helicopter pilot. Well, they diagnosed me with adult onset asthma. They permanently grounded me and told me I had to find a new job. So they were kicking me out of the military. And so I was sitting there going, what am I going to do? Like, I was going to, and this is like almost 8 years of active duty service when they told me I had to leave.
Which has to be the closest thing to achieving your first dream a little bit, considering what it was. Like, I would assume, I mean, the military is the kind of the de facto want for naught to some end, right? Not that you're highly paid, but everything is taken care of.
I attribute the military, the Army more specifically, to saving my life. I had no structure. I mean, I was a hard worker, but I didn't have structure. The Army gave me that. The Army gave me the confidence to do things that were well outside of my comfort zone. You know, when I was enlisted, I was a parachute rigger. So everything airborne I did, I skydived, I was a jump master, I was a parachutist. I was pathfinder, you know, everything that I could do, I did it when it was involving airborne operations. So yeah, that dream was, I wasn't making a whole lot of money. And it's funny because I have two sons in the military now and they tell me how much they make. And I'm just like, wow, I'm so happy for you. When I was in the Army, I literally, before taxes, was making $770 a month. Take home was about $450. Now, granted, that was like 30 years ago. But no, it got me out of my neighborhood. And I was able to have some semblance of a normal life. You know, I didn't have to worry about where I was going to eat at. I didn't have to worry about taking care of anyone other than myself. But when I had to get out of the Army, at that time, I was married and I had my first two kids and I had to have a job to support them. What was I going to do? And I looked at some jobs here and there and I was just like, man, my ego got the best of me. And I was like, I'm a freaking Black Hawk helicopter pilot. I'm not going to go do that job. That's beneath me. I'm a very different person than I was in my 20s. But, you know, law enforcement. Law enforcement had the structure. It was very quasi-militaristic. I understood it, and I was like, I need a job. So the Phoenix Police Department was hiring, and I was one of the lucky few that got invited to be a member of that department. And man, the rest is history. You know, I've been able to help so many people in my short 22 years that I never knew what I was getting into back then compared to what I know now. That's how that transition came to fruition.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. That's it's fascinating. I feel like I don't want to, but I feel like we're supposed to wrap up. I feel like that's a good wrap up point. So we wrap up with two questions around here, Will.
All right.
We have a motto at Lockbod, and that is, if we have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. Who's been a giant or two in your life that you want to pay homage to?
I don't have two, but I'm going to say I have two groups. One is my mother.
Okay.
I tell you, I never realized how much she went through, how much I put her through to, growing up, when she was still alive. And I can look back now and I'm happy that the traits that I have today mirror that of my mom's. Never saw that. Never saw that when I was younger. The second, so that's one, but then there are five people in my life that have been giants, and I call them the five. They were my five high school teachers, and I was in a special program, not for gifted kids, not for kids that needed extra help, but I think, looking back now, it's probably a special program for students who are probably at high risk of not making it through high school. And case in point, I didn't make it. But these five teachers were so special in my life that they would literally drive my English teacher's minivan to my house and they would bang on the door to get me to go to school because I was not a good student. And I hated them for it, right? Teachers showing up at my house, dragging me to school. Well, when I left my neighborhood, I felt like I had let them down. And, that failure, that guilt has driven me to the edges of my dreams, right? And it's because of those five. Now, oddly enough, I have since then reconnected with two because I wrote a paper to them after I took a leadership course at the FBI National Academy. And, the very question was asked, like, who was the most influential people in your life? And I wrote a paper and I sent it to my social studies teacher, who was actually the principal of the high school that I went to, not expecting any response or anything like that, but he emailed me back and he carbon copied two of the other teachers. One was his brother. He was my history teacher. And my English teacher was the other one. I think I hated her the most. Her and I have since reconnected and have created a bond that I never saw coming. And, when I was telling her of like, what was going on in my life, because we reconnected on Facebook and she just told me, she goes, Will, I'm so proud of you. And I tell you what, man, I've had a lot of people tell me they were proud of me, but when she said it, it was overwhelming. It was just absolutely amazing. So those five and my mom.
That's cool, man. You've teared me up a couple times on this one. So the second question is, what's a guiding principle in your life that you found to be true again and again and again? I like to liken this as like your North Star.
Yeah. It may sound cliche, but for me, it's so powerful. And I will just say integrity. I tell people that the reason why, when people say, Will, you're so approachable, no matter where I see you at, you're always the same person. And I explain to them, I'm like, you know what? This is all I have. Like, if you take everything else away from me, the kind of person that I am, that's all I am. And I say that, I am always the same person, no matter where you find me, no matter what environment we're in, because it's easier to be the person who I am, because I don't have to be special for one group and then try to be something for another group. And then a person from the other group is in that group and they go, hey, who's this guy? No. So along with that, it's, when I give you my word, that's as good as gold. And if you ask my kids about promises, they will tell you dad doesn't make promises because I never know what variable will enter into that circumstance where I can't keep my promise. And when I break a promise, it is devastating to me. So I am definitely a man of my word. So if I think integrity catches it, but it's I am who I am.
I like that. I like to say if I'm 90% sure, that's other people's certain. That's great. So to get more of your story, how can people connect with you, Will?
Wow.
Other than calling an emergency line.
Please don't do that. It's my Facebook page is open. You know, I am so open on my personal Facebook page, and much to my wife's dismay, because she feels like we have to have a private life. But, you know, that's one of the sacrifices that I have willingly accepted, that my life is no longer private. Now, there are private things in our life that I'm not going to display for the world to see, but go to my Facebook page. Do you want to see the kind of person I am? I mean, that's a really good illustration of who I am, because that's how I always am. The Washdown. And there's actually two episodes in the Washdown podcast. And the one that you had mentioned earlier, that was actually almost 3 hours in length. We went into so much detail in that episode that we lost track of time. But they invited.
I have no doubt. I mean, I'm not kidding, folks, when I say 20 minutes in and it's like, whoa, you're just kind of like wrapped into it with you guys. It was beautiful.
Yeah. You know, but they did a second episode, and I think we went for a couple of hours. But, you know, and I'm in the process of writing a book, you know, and this book has been relatively easy to write. But the book is a realistic fiction. And, you know, without going into too much detail, I will just say that everything that you will read about in this book has either happened to me personally, or it was a call for service that I went on. And I mix childhood, I mix law enforcement, I mix Afghanistan, and I mix, you know, the military, all in this one book. And it's going to really shed some light on the kind of person I am, the things that I've gone through in my life. But the reason why it's realistic fiction and not another leadership book or anything like that is because I'm putting things in there that really only my therapist knows about. And so realistic fiction allows me to write what I need to write to get out of my brain, but never have to go, oh yeah, that happened to me. Let me go into more detail about that traumatic experience. I can just say, no, that's just a part of the book. You're going to have to go with that. but you know, the last way
I like that. Yeah. And then you don't have to worry as much too, if you're calling out somebody or something, because
No, not at all.
That's a good way of putting it.
But the last piece is, you know what? If you ever want to have a conversation, if you want to have a cup of coffee or something like that, reach out. You know, send me an email, send me a text message. Don't call me. There are a lot of people who want to sell me things and want to like bite my ear off. So I never answer calls from phone numbers that aren't programmed in my phone. But if you send me an email or even a direct message on Messenger or Instagram or something like that, you know, I always respond. Sometimes it takes me days to get back, but I always get back. And, you know, on Facebook, you know, it's just Will Aiken, as my personal profile, Sheriff Will Aiken for my official page. I'm not as responsive on that page because everything on that page is subject to sunshine. So I always refer them back to another way that we can talk, or Instagram, which is Dr. Will Aiken, or I'm sorry, Dr. Will 816. Dr. Will 816. That's my Instagram handle. And of course, LinkedIn. LinkedIn is always a great. So those are the ways you can get in touch with me.
Love it. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And thank you, Will, for being on.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Hello, everybody. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.